Hello and welcome to the VFX Show. I'm Mike Seymour, back as we are in 2010 with our new format, everything really. We've basically, as you know, kind of slightly altered. I want to say revamp, but it's not that serious. The show, if you've been listening regularly, you'll know that we sort of review the shows and discuss the visual effects in particular. But what we're going to be doing from now on is not only reviewing the shows, discussing the visual effects, but also trying to pick a topic that relates and somehow places it contextually in the overall environment. And our panel of stars all start with the word Jason this week.
Just starting, to annoy you.
Starting with Jace, who I'm going to be referring to as Jace and okay. Not Jason, which Good. Is Jason Wingrove.
Hey, Mike. How are you, mate?
Good. Now, our second Jason, just to make life confusing, which I'll be referring to as Jason, is Jason Diamond, coming to us from New York. How are you, sir?
Cold.
Cold. Okay. Well, we've been suffering really heat wave conditions here, so there you go. So, Jace is here in the studio in Sydney. Jason is in New York, but we're all here to discuss Sherlock Holmes, which is the, I guess, I don't know how I should describe it, whether it's a reimagining, a reboot, or how does this film's depravity know no bounds? I do not know. The game is afoot. So this is a really interesting film. As always, we're going to discuss the visual effects. But the other thing I wanted to touch on as our theme to sort of reference to is just the nature of doing period pieces, be them period dramas or period action pieces, because quite frankly, whether it's Sherlock Holmes or one of the other large-scale period films we've seen, there is a lot to be done, and also a sort of a different class of visual effects to be done, because let's face it, London is a very well-known city. People really pick up on where monuments are and when they were built and what they do. They know a lot about it. It's not a fictitious place. You're not breaking the laws of physics, or at least you shouldn't be. You're trying to build a very accurate and yet a very different world than what we live in right now. But let's do as we always do, start with just our review of the film point blank. And I'm going to start with you, Jace. This is a film that is surprisingly, I guess, directed by somebody who wouldn't be my first choice for a Sherlock Holmes film.
Yeah, I mean, this is... it's almost like Guy had a ghost director or something in. I mean, I love, you know, Snatch and Lockstock and a lot of other of Guy's movies, but
you're referring to Guy Ritchie.
Guy Ritchie, the director. It doesn't feel like his style. I mean, there is some remnants of his style, but it just feels so much a real departure, but in a good way.
Well, now, the reason I wanted to ask you that is because you are a director, and my hesitation would be, because I would normally say, well, yeah, this isn't Lock, Stock and Two Smoking Barrels, this isn't Snatch, but how fair is that to a director to so typecast them that they can only make the urban, gritty, kind of gangster-esque kind of film? I mean, is that a reasonable thing for a director to be, you know, not his type of film? Can a director just have any type they want?
No, I mean, I guess in a way he kind of probably got the finance for Lock, Stock. Which was first?
Snatch was second. Lock, Stock was first.
Yeah, I mean, he may have got sort of money and scripts and you know, might have got a green light for, you know, the second one based on the first film. So I think maybe this is just his chance to break away. Obviously, the other two films, or his first few films, were, you know, reasonably low budget. This is like $90 million budget. This is, you know, all of a sudden you get to, you know, really start to explore what maybe he may not have had the ability to do before. This may be, you know, his true style. It's really kind of hard to tell, I guess. But I guess.
Is it the style answer. Defined by what you can get funding for? In other words, if you know that I can make a really good guy goes around London, and, you know, is a bit of a villain,
yeah,
and shoots people, and that's what I get funding for? Or is it more that, you know, Tarantino's always going to make Tarantino's?
Oh, I mean, I guess Tarantino's style is pretty hard to pin down too when you look at, he's done a lot, he's quite a broad sort of, you know, there's been a whole breadth of styles for him and locations and feels, I guess, even though they're all, you know, do have his mark on them. I think you probably, if you're a good director, and I like to think I
you're
do this.
Director.
Oh, no, like, no, thanks.
You are.
I like to think I do this with commercials. That would be that you apply the style that best suits that script and that story, and regardless of your own personal style, you apply the right style for that script and what it needs. I mean, and there's just enough of his past styles creeping in there to sort of spice it up, I guess, and take it from being a stuffy period piece.
Jason, we're a colony out here, so we know everything about English things. Was Guy really well known in the USA? Was that a director you had really on your radar?
Yeah, yeah. I think between Rock and Roller, Snatch, and Lock, Stock, maybe not a household name, but I think, you know, anyone who goes to the movies fairly regularly knows who he is. Especially, obviously, being married to Madonna kind of puts you up on the marquee, maybe even places you don't want to be. But, I mean, you know, people know his name.
It's a pedigree with Sean Penn that's pretty impressive.
But, yeah.
Hey, let me ask you this. Do you know anything about his next film, Gamekeeper? Is that of a similar genre, or is that just going... I have no idea. Anyone?
I don't know anything about it.
No, I don't know. No, I had purely presumed that his next film, from what I read... Pre-production for this, for Sherlock 2, is meant to start in March. So,
they're going to Sherlock 2?
Well, that's what I understood.
I mean, it looked like they were going to.
Yeah, that's what I had recently read.
If he's smart. It would
be mad not to. I mean, from a $90 million budget, it's now made close to $300 million already. So it's almost like, you know, the contract is probably being limoed to Guy's apartment now on the silver platter. I'm presuming ready for him to sign with his own Mont Blanc pen to keep after the signing. I presume he can write his own check.
That's how they get you to sign on for things.
Well, exactly right. That's how it happens for me.
Look, the only thing I know about Guy Ritchie's next production is what I read on the net, which, and I'll just quote it. It says, "The reclusive caretaker of a Scottish estate has an infinite knowledge of the behaviours of all animal species. When an alleged killer of a son surfaces, the caretaker finds that European urban jungle is not quite like the natural landscape he's accustomed to. Adapted from Guy Ritchie's Virgin comic book series." Now,
okay.
A reason I reference that is not because I want to discuss Gamekeeper, but Jason, this to me is Sherlock Holmes, the filming of the Marvel comic. Even though, of course, Sherlock Holmes never was a Marvel comic, it feels like Sherlock Holmes was a Marvel comic, and Marvel decided to make a film on it, and they got Ritchie to do it. Is that fair, or do you feel this is a valid pedigree from the Conan Doyle?
I mean, I never read the books, but from what I understand, the books were a little more gritty, less stuffy than I think maybe some of the more later interpretations were BBC stuff and whatnot. I think the Grenada series or whatever.
And the Star Trek The Next Generation holodeck versions.
Yeah.
I mean, because as I understand it, and I've read some, but it was years ago. But in doing research for this, someone was pointing out online that there was a reference in the film where he says, "You know what you're drinking is for eye surgery," which is apparently an obscure reference to Sherlock Holmes' cocaine use. And Sherlock was basically shooting up. And my point is that that's not the Sherlock Holmes that springs to mind. But also, it's not this film either, really. It feels like this film is a more action, adventure-y version. Did you like it overall, Jason?
I actually really liked it. And I mean, I like Guy Ritchie, but he's a little... stylized, and like Jace was saying, I can't tell if that's the movies he wants to make, or those are the movies he had to make, or what, budgetarily or creatively or whatnot. But it feels to me like in this, he sat down with somebody who said, "Okay, Guy, here's your bag of tricks. Here's all the stuff that you do. Here's how to do them properly, and you know, pace them and use them." With motivation and with reason. And I'm not saying that to disparage his earlier films, because this is a film that needs that kind of thought beyond like a cool, you know, visual.
Yeah, I mean, there is a place for the Cranford miniseries of this world, and there are, you know, a place for films that are going to rock the kind of money that would allow you to go on to build a big franchise. I mean, if we move past Sherlock Holmes the superhero for a second. There is one plot point that is kind of a plot theme, I guess, which is that I just want to establish right up front. Did you guys have any plausibility problems with the deductive reasoning? Was it still in the zone of, you know, a Sherlock Holmes brilliant guy, or did it elevate to this guy has supernatural powers in his ability to do the deduction, Jace?
What I loved, it was really great to see a film that took all the bullshit out of, you know, the supernatural, and gave the script gave every single thing essentially a grounding in science, and you know, poo-pooed a lot of, you know, stuff like The Mummy and stuff, which is half the script. They can just kind of get around a lot of stuff just through, you know, the black magic and mythology and all that sort of rubbish, and you know, Indy 4 and all that sort of stuff, which really should be a bit more grounded. And it's just they kind of, a lot of films just sort of get a little bit airy-fairy, and it was really good to see all of that that's basically being broken down, and Moriarty essentially being broken down into an illusionist rather than anybody doing black magic. So I thought it was really...
Because the reason I bring that up is I think it's a really key point when you're judging the visual effects, because I think you can only judge the visual effects inside the context of what the film is doing. If the film is fantastic, then they can break the laws of physics and we're okay with it, right? If it's a grounded in reality film, there are no trickery. There is no trickery that, you know, is of a supernatural nature.
I guess that's what the whole, most of the reason, I guess, why I really liked the film, because I was really going into expecting, you know, The Mummy with pipes and deerstalkers. You know, I was expecting a really fantasy-based thing where anything's possible, like a lot of problems we've had structurally with the films that we've reviewed has been, you end up not caring because, you know, everything's imaginary, no one can die, everyone's sort of, you know, so there's a...
I did love the relationship between him and Watson. It just had a fresh air to it. Watson, A, wasn't a bumbly old guy who was just there to give you... Because that's the problem, isn't it? You really don't want... I need to have some exposition now, so could you have somebody walk up to Holmes so he can explain it to that person so the audience gets it?
Yeah.
And getting Watson to be more than exposition guy was a good move. I felt really strong about that.
Well, that's where I think it actually stayed pretty close to the original books, not having read any of them, but what is becoming clear is that everything that all the imagining so far and all the, you know, the BBC films and the Michael Caine films have all been a load of crap, and the whole deerstalker thing was an invention, and so much of that, and the magnifying glass, all of that is really the Hollywood touches on the books, and that whole cocaine use and Sherlock being a bit of a drunkard and a layabout, and Watson being the one that sort of essentially keeps him on the straight and narrow and rescues him and brings, you know, and keeps him in check and in line and be quite a strong character and a really great balance to the Sherlock's character is actually quite grounded in the books. So from what I understand,
I feel like in this Watson was the Tom Cruise to Holmes's Rain Man. In a sense, you know.
Oh, I wish I'd said that.
Yes, that sort of savant. Because, yeah, I mean, I know that I've heard the character of, at least in this film, of Holmes being described. He is a superhero, and his secret weapon is his mind. You know, it's quite amazing that he has these fallibilities and addictions and, you know...
Yeah.
Has this amazing ability and knows, and
you had that bit where he thought out how he was going to hit somebody. See, because me, that made
was
a big
incredible
difference.
I love that.
Yeah, it's like, if I think this through, I know how to pull this off.
Yeah,
and that just made hitting a guy 8 times and having him fall over actually kind of much more viable. Hey, Jason, can I ask you a question? I was appalled at the quality of the projection of the print that I went to. Now, I saw this at a professional cinema at a full on, like, you know, it was early in the run. There was no reason for it to be bad. And yet, for me, it almost felt, and I actually said this to my wife who was with me, I said, this almost feels like somebody's videotaped this off the screen and is reprojecting it again. And now, you're, of course, in America, you've got a completely different distribution system. What was the quality of the print like? Was it sharp and crisp, or did it have a kind of muddy quality?
I'm trying to think. I don't think it was uber, like, you know, well, it wasn't digital, but it wasn't like Avatar crisp, but it was like, it wasn't a first run. It didn't look like a first run. You know what I mean?
Hmm.
It was
because I've got to say, I looked at it and I was like, oh my God, I should be watching this at home on my backlit LED off a Blu-ray because it looks so much better.
I agree. I made mental notes. I made notes here in the dark that it was a crappy print. I've long held this thought that they send all the shitty prints down to the Antipodes for us. You know, any stuff that gets rejected off the American pile just puts in the Aussie bin. But I don't know whether maybe it was like the third act. There was a real change for me in our prints. It looked like all of a sudden it was like the run out of a daylight load, 16 mil daylight load. It all of a sudden went orange, like someone had opened the camera door.
It was appalling prints.
It was never quite all the way through. It was never quite sharp. It never really quite
yes,
felt
it was never quite sharp.
Sharp.
Exactly. Yeah. It didn't have very good resolution.
I know for about 90% of it, it was all shot on 35mm.
Yeah.
But yet it did feel like there was smear or blur or there was something. There was almost like shutter blur, which is, you know, essentially mostly impossible.
It's like
for,
they were using a 1920x1080 projector.
Yeah. It was like it was shot 1080 and it was being upscaled. It didn't look great.
I'm really hoping that isn't the film, which is why I want Jason to. Sort of because the very fact you hesitated and didn't immediately jump on it means you must have a better quality.
Yeah, nothing jumped out at me. I just may have seen like a fairly well run print, but it wasn't like I don't think there were any projection or display issues.
Yes, this print should have been rejected.
Yeah, and we were at different sessions by the way, just for people listening. We didn't go at the same time, but
it's not that kind of relationship.
But the thing is that. But Jason, yeah, so that's good. That means we don't need to pick that up because if you'd seen the same thing, then I'd have been willing to tear into the DI. But yeah,
there was an overall.
I think you guys just were in a dodgy theater.
We got
there was an overall softness.
This was like the main, you know, proper. Well, I'll name it. It was in my case, it was Hoyts, and it's you know, at a new complex and a major screening area. Anyway, so let's leave that and assume that was not the film's fault, but their distributor's fault. Which, by the way, I think is a really valid point. Which is, you know, you can do the best thing in the world with your DI grade, but if you have a distributor that lets you down in terms of the release prints, you know, what a crying shame. Okay, so let's move on to the visual effects and discuss this whole issue of the visual effects in this film, but also just this idea of doing a period piece. And Jason, the visual effects seem to be coming out of DNEG and Framestore, but before I get into that, I need to issue an apology because the last time I had this discussion where I said the film discussed a shot, it was in 2012. Now, in Avatar, I got it completely right, I hope, but in 2012, I actually screwed up and did not discuss the role that Uncharted played in the production of the sequence here on the VFX show. So right now I'm going to just say that we're onto that, we're correcting that, we're talking to the guys at Uncharted about doing a special thing with them, highlighting their work. So again, I just want to make the point, when we talk about the VFX here on this show, we go based not on first-hand interviews often because we are not interviewing people from the film normally, but we're just going off our research and watching the film or as a reviewer. So I say that because if we forget somebody or miss somebody, this shouldn't be taken as the definitive. But I'm right in thinking that DNEG and Frameworks were the two primary houses from your understanding, Jason?
Yeah, from what I could tell.
So so in terms of reproducing London, these are two very, very good British effects houses. They're both exceptional work. How did you think they scored? Did it feel like it was a realistic depiction of London, or did you feel like you were watching moving matte paintings?
No, actually, I thought they were really nice. Everything was... I mean, I don't obviously know what... I'm not a historian of London pre-double World Wars, but it felt real. It didn't feel like, you know, set, move to a matte painting, move to CG. It felt very seamless, including what I've... you know, read in other articles and things of things that they said were digital and what weren't, and to me that didn't even stand out as differences in the film. So I would say kudos.
I mean, the film was taking place in around 1891, and a lot of that part of what you might call Victorian England was destroyed in the Blitz. So there was an enormous amount of CG. Jace, if you didn't know, what would you have pegged as the shot count on this film?
I would say, I don't know, 80.
And Jason?
Shot count for the whole film?
If you didn't know, and you came out of the cinema, what would you, I mean, how big an effects film did it feel in terms of shot count?
A couple hundred at least. I mean, I know what that is, but I'm saying if I ballparked it.
I'm with you. I would have gone 250, probably more than that because I didn't notice it, so maybe 400. And in fact, the number that we understand it to be is closer to like 850.
Yeah.
And so I think that's a really big compliment to
both. I was close.
No, but I'm not offering that up as by way of criticizing you so much as it is complimenting Dean Egan.
Well, exactly right. There's so many of those little effect shots that you don't even notice these days because they look so real. And
so many of those big effect shots because there is just such little ability to shoot in and around London. If you haven't been to London, London doesn't look like this.
No.
Yeah. I mean, all that stuff around the Thames is literally only about sort of 10 or just a handful of those buildings that actually would still exist now, obviously, House of Parliament. I mean, there's a lot of stuff there that really, at that time, is no longer existing. So just even the simple stuff around Tower Bridge is a massive, you know, essentially invention.
Well, that's the thing about period pieces, to sort of stick to the theme, is that once you announce it, you know, the audience knows it's a period piece, it might as well be Avatar. You know what I mean? Like, in terms of believability, because the audience has no preconception. So for it to just work and not have you be like, wow, what's that? What's, you know, like, that is even an even better job. You know what I mean? Because there's no reference.
I mean, I know London. I've been there many times. And so, you know, for example, when they were crossing over to Parliament, I was like, oh, well, I've stood on that bridge today kind of thing, thinking, wow, how much did you have to take out in that shot? But there were streets that had like 8 houses and the rest of it was set extensions. And so that was a massive amount of work. So I guess the question is, looking at the film, was the most impressive visual effects for you stuff like those great shots down the Thames with all the boats? Because I actually have an unusual thing that just struck me as being marvelous in this picture. But I'll ask you guys first, Jace, what sort of struck you as the best aspect of visual effects?
Actually, I thought, because I know that it's really hard to do and there was so many elements that needed to click together to make it work, was actually their little night trip on the Thames on the little tugboat thing. And it just was so lovely. There's, you know, obviously reflections of the factory lights in the water and a really wonderful night sky. I can only presume there's so much that is created there that I'm presuming the usual, like a build of the boat in a gimbal, all digital water, all the the reflections, moonlight. So many departments had to really click there to make that sort of lovely. It really, really felt there was a lot of natural movement in the camera, and it really just honestly felt entirely real to me. I mean, there was a lot of fantastic, you know, wonderful, all those key, fantastic tracking shots where you reveal looking down the Thames with sailboats and Tower Bridge in the background in mid-construction. I think that night, the evening boat trips was a standout for me.
What about you, Jason?
I think maybe just more because it was that's more of a subtle thing. I sort of soaked that stuff in and just let it go by and just appreciated that it could be so subtle. To me, the scene that really, it's more just a couple shots. So I think it's like 8 shots total, is the explosion at the warehouse later when they're being, you know, blown around in 120 frames per second. The fact that they combined serious amounts of practical in camera and on set effects versus some compositing. I mean, it's really, they were using air cannons where the explosions would be on set to blow the actors around so that it would, you know, you'd have some real physics going on. And then they shot all the explosions. It's real fire over green so that they could composite in real elements. I mean, that's a nice attention to detail when they could have just said, fuck it, we're just going to do it all CG and do a couple.
Yeah, that is not how I imagined that sequence being shot, and then I found out later how they shot it, and I thought that was just absolutely sensational, a really, really great approach, and it was utterly faultless. You're right.
That to me was the perfect marriage of Guy Ritchie, who's a very capable director, but also technically quite hip, and you know, it was an original take. But it wasn't so over the top that it was, you know, Die Hard 4 where, you know, he got, or Mission Impossible or something where they got blown, you know, 16 ways from sun. And you go, well, there's no way anyone could have got out alive. Like when he grabs that piece of board or whatever it is to use it as a sort of shield. And
yeah, and all debris hits it and bounces off. And then that debris is also on fire and hits the ground and ricochets along the ground. and that stuff is actually, you know, matted in later and interacts later with a on, like a MoCo shot that they shot against green. But I think it's just sensational.
I mean,
and
seriously, even more to.
I was going to say, seriously, when I saw that shot, like, before I started to try and think about, because it was so, you know, slow, you could even watch it and try and figure out how it was being done without taking yourself out of it. I the first thought in my head was like, I know they're not really on fire, but they're really on fire. You know what I mean? Like, it was dead nuts, you know, right on.
So what's even more exceptional, I think, is that not only was that sequence exquisite, but as you say, they used real flames because they reconstructed that section that they were running on, the ones that had no flames and air cannons to give velocity and impact to the bodies of the actors. They recreated that on green and then used real flames and then comped those two together. A superb job, but even more superb when you understand that the scene in which the guy is at the secret society thing and he fires the gun and it causes himself to explode, that they weren't able to film flame in that location. So that was digital fire on that guy.
Now, that's one of those little ones that you don't even notice. I thought that was in camera. That, and there was a couple of other little things which were little tiny little stuff that I thought was literally, you know, on set. Like the pig carcasses in
later
on.
But before we even get to the pig carcasses, the thing is that if you can do digital flames that friggin'
good.
That
was amazing.
Then you go to the meeting and they go, well, I want to have the guy running up and down with flames coming out in slow motion. You're like, well, we can do good flames. I mean, I so can't imagine that someone wouldn't have said that at the meeting. Yeah, we can do good flames. Look. And then you'd be like, show them that's, you know, well, if you could do that.
And it was really unexpected and it just looked so real.
But they did one superb set of volumetric kind of flames, fully digital, and then they did the other set. And you know what? That's the mark of a good combination of effects guys, when you don't have just one trick and milk it. You know what I mean? Like for each thing, they just tackled it whichever was the right way. Even though on paper at the early meetings, you could have easily gone, well, there's a few flame sequences here. How are we going to do the flames? And have jumped them in as kind of one job lot of, you know.
Stepping back to that, to the explosion, the long shot, what made, and obviously what also helps to make the VFX shots seem so more wonderful, is that just that overall absolutely bow down, hats off awesomeness to Guy for constructing that sequence. It's beautifully shot, beautifully choreographed, wonderful use of lack of sound, and just that purely the music track over the top of it. It was just a sensationally
and great cinematography, because that framing, having the camera low at what would have been about waist height or lower, just added so much more drama to that shot, and having them crouching, than it would have had you been flying down on a kind of lumacrone.
It's a sensational piece of, as a whole, a sensational piece of filmmaking where everybody came together and just nailed that for however long it was.
They even
2 minutes, however long.
They even went so far as to build, apparently they built green dummy replicas of Jude Law and Robert Downey Jr. so that when the flame hit the bodies, it would wrap around them so that they composited it later. It would work without having to, you know, put in any volumetric sims or anything.
Interesting that they went with real flame for that, having nailed flame so well earlier on.
Yeah.
Because it was so slow, I guess, that you just, at that speed, you couldn't quite. I guess it's just too much little detail in there to.
But I mean, the flames on the guy when the gun goes off, that is good work.
That was good. And it was surprising. You weren't expecting it. And it was shocking and it was impactful and just,
And that wasn't exactly like a scene in a wide shot. You know, that went off and. And I seem to remember that shot. Obviously, I don't have it in front of me. I seem to remember that shot being kind of slow-mo-y when it first ignites up his arm. It wasn't like a puff, and it was done. So,
well, and then then it goes back to Blackwood's perspective, looking at the camera and over his shoulder in the background, out of focus. You know, with a really nice depth of field, the guy's on
nice
fire.
Nice one, Centurion. Yeah, I know exactly. It's just like good stuff. Yeah. Now, look, I mean, and this is, I guess, the problem with being on a period drama that I dare say, and look, it's the good thing and it's the bad thing, but here we are getting so excited about this stuff because it visually was so impactful, whereas, as you so accurately said, Jason, you kind of need to build your environment so that they wash over, because they aren't the plot. See, the point about these effects we're talking about is that those moments in time, those visual effects were the plot. They were the point of the shot.
Yeah.
Whereas
that's right.
The backgrounds aren't the point of the shot often. I mean, okay, you've got an establishing shot. Maybe there's some geography we need to know. But see, the least exciting shots for me, I guess, in a way, are the we're standing on the London Bridge, sort of under construction, helicopter shots from impossible camera positions, where really it's just a mega dramatic location, but it feels like an early Bond film. Jason Wingrove is making the universal sign of what a wanker, but I don't know if that's for me or the film.
No, it's not for you.
But Jason, wouldn't you agree? Like it's just, you know, like it's, when you're more in there with it, like we were in these other shots, I felt like it was just stronger than this big finish up on top of the London Bridge.
Yeah, I think when the what would be, let's say, if it weren't a period piece, what would be a plate, when it becomes, you know, this massive digital reconstruction and development acts as a plate, is when it really functions properly. Like, you know, and not just a matte painting, but matte painting, apparently from some of the high perspective shots, they had to model textures and geometry for like a half a mile in scale in either direction, and then
they didn't just do camera projections, right? Which I would have done, just some bloody matte paintings and camera projected them. But yeah, go on.
Yeah, well, they did do some camera projection later in some other shots, but I mean, you know, that's dedication. Granted, they're being paid to do the work, but like you said, there's shortcuts that probably would look 90% as good, but they just went for it and it disappears, which is what you want.
I think the midpoint between those two things is the fight sequence at the shipyard, because now we've got obviously a lot of digital set extension, but there is more geography that matters to plot, because we need to know spatial relationships. The threat isn't real. There are some gags about whether they will or wouldn't be run over by this or that. Jace, what did you think about that sequence in terms of our backgrounds? I'm not talking about the final section of the boat going down, but that whole environment of the boatyard, because I thought that was pretty good.
Yeah, I thought it was great, actually. It really felt, it did look, I mean, obviously they built a whole lot of the ship. It certainly didn't look fake. It did fall apart a little bit, as you say, later on when the capstan starts flying for them, it didn't quite...
the capstan at the end, and the speed at which the ship sank, which anyone that knows anything about yachting or boating or anything knows that it takes like a long time for a bit. Well, anyone who watched Titanic knows that it takes quite a long time for a ship to sink.
You're a boating man. I'm sure you've sunk the odd boat.
Yes. But
it really looked great, and the atmosphere and the lighting and everything in there. I mean, I presume obviously they had the original warehouse that was shot in to work from. From my understanding, started with
completely recreated digitally.
Yeah, but the original warehouse was there to work from.
Yeah, they did LiDAR scans of the whole practical set for recreation later.
Look, it did feel like, as a sequence being shot, it felt like there was no real restrictions for them to work through, that Guy had plenty of room to move and he could shoot what he needed to get that sequence. It didn't feel like the average kind of totally green screen shoot where you're quite restricted and everything's bolted down because it's all boarded out and it's all previs. It did feel like it was quite free, and it had a nice, you know, pace and a push to it. So it didn't feel, you know, a second unit guy had just sort of ticked off the boxes as you went through. So
there's a shot in Pirates of the Caribbean 3 where the two guys, Johnny Depp and whose name escapes me, you know, but the sword fighting on a boom of the ship. So right. They're basically balancing while sword fighting, while things are blowing up, while the ship is spinning around a large, you know, hole in the universe and sucking down. Now, I can totally appreciate the immense complexity of the water sims in that, right? And just think it's a gorgeous shot. But quite frankly, it's so far beyond my ability to believe that someone could balance up there even for a split second, yet alone for an entire sword sequence, while everything's going on, while you're spinning around, blah, 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 that it just so took me out of the film completely. And to a minor extent, I would say that's why I think the shipyard scene works better than does the end sequence up on the bridge, because the sequence in the shipyard...
What? It's grounded in more ways than one.
Yeah, and, you know, people were tripping over, they were hitting and they weren't necessarily knocking out. It wasn't, you know, the camera wasn't swooping in and doing spin-arounds the boat and up and down. It was just you know.
It was a straight out fight scene, really. But I mean, there's a bit of effects at the end, but you know, it felt
a bit of wit in there, drama, misdirection.
Well, it was a real set, though.
Yeah. Well, so, but then there was a fully digital reconstruction of it as well.
Right, but I'm saying,
they could have done the fly round.
Right, but I'm saying, but the principal photography was what it was, to a certain extent.
But also, they broke that. I mean, when you're looking at the Tower Bridge sequence, what they did was break that fourth wall and go put the camera out in space. Where, you know, theoretically, if you want to keep that real, you'd always put the camera where it could possibly conceivably be rigged, where it could always be, you know, safely put and subconsciously keep it that little bit realer. It's when you start sort of doing...
Well, I'm certainly not saying that the end sequence was crap.
It was very well done. It was,
Ship was better.
The problem is that almost the very first shot of that sequence, you get taken right out of the movie. And then if you look at it, I find it really hard to nail where there's actually anything wrong. The lighting and the comping and the water and the backgrounds and everything looks fantastic. I struggle to find out why doesn't it feel real, and maybe you just get taken out of the film in the very first shot, and then from then on it's
Well, actually, I was talking to a friend of mine about the film from a plot perspective, and the end fight scene, he brought up something I didn't even think of that would have been perfect, is what should have happened in that end fight scene with Blackwood should have been where he thinks they go back to the deductive reasoning, slow motion Holmes gag, have him figure out how he's going to disable Blackwood and have Blackwood do something different than he assumed he would do, and allow the plot to move forward that way from a fight perspective.
That would have been good, wouldn't it? Yeah, because that already set that up really well in the early. I hadn't thought of that.
Yeah, I didn't either.
Also, did anyone else have a problem with the fact that Sherlock Holmes explained how the guy burst into flames even though Sherlock wasn't there and didn't witness it, and how did he even know about it?
He wasn't there? No, I didn't even... Just completely...
Why would he suddenly explain how somebody did something to somebody that he didn't care about, that he didn't see, that had no impact on him?
No, but I'm glad he did explain it. But he wasn't. I didn't even really put those two and two together that he wasn't actually even in the same room.
I just hate exposition.
Sorry, go ahead, Mike. Sorry.
True.
Well, no, doesn't you think that? It's like, as an audience, right? It's like, I want you to tell me in ways that aren't as obvious. See, my classic piece of exposition is in the book 1984, when they pick up a book and they just read it. It explains everything. And then they put the book down again and the story continues, right?
Wow.
And in that book, I love 1984 as a book, but it's the most amazing piece of, like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm just going to, like, tell you how this works, and then I'll get back to the story.
They had a bit of fun with it. I quite liked it. There's some sequence, and he says, how did you work it out? And he says, well, let me explain. And they cut to this fantastic rapid-fire cut sequence.
The only mystery is why you even bother putting a hood on me.
Yes. No. I think it was Holmes and Watson back at Baker Street, and he asked him to explain a certain, how did you know? And he did the backstory of how he changed and then got out on the street and bumped into the carriage and all that sort of stuff. It was really quick. It was actually it was actually quite classic kind of guy.
I really like that section because you don't know who she just leaves. It's the end of the scene. You're like, oh, scene's done. Yeah. She's talking to the mystery guy. And they come back and you're like, wait, where am I in time? I'm going back in time now. Like, but with no explanation, then you're like, oh, I get it. And it totally works. And they don't have to explain it to you. You immediately get it.
Yeah, and you know what? I did, like, suddenly notice that she was holding flowers. And I thought, oh, just a continuity problem, right? But I guess they just maybe made an edit. But it was like, I guess only a geek like me would notice she was suddenly holding flowers in the next shot. And then they were fully explained why she was suddenly holding flowers in the next shot.
It makes you, once you sort of watch it and you kind of think, oh, actually, I really want to act. You actually do want to. Like Sixth Sense in a way. If you look at Sixth Sense, that you can actually enjoy it a second time once you know a lot of the backstory, and once you know and know how much detail M. Night put into the front part of the story before the twist. When you go back and see it again, particularly say the DVD with the commentary, which you must do, by the way. Everyone should listen to the DVD commentary for a Sixth Sense. It is astoundingly brilliant. The level of level of crazy
detail. The use of the color red.
The color red and safety and all that sort of stuff. Same with this. Actually, now having sort of seen all that, it makes you want to then go back and I actually want to go see it again, actually. It's a really,
But Jason, I derailed you as you're about to comment on something that somebody, I think, commented to you about.
Oh, right, yeah. An editor, another editor friend of mine had said that every movie has one thing that if it worked properly would make the movie impossible, no matter what.
Would make the movie impossible? How do you mean?
In terms of the plot, would the problem would have been solved earlier or differently or whatever. Yeah. So you could, you know, you could say maybe that's the fire scene where he explains it. They just got to keep the plot moving along. Don't, nothing to see here. Finish the scene, move on, you know.
Yeah,
true.
Yeah.
If they just killed Blackwood in the very first temple scene.
Well, yeah, but you know, that's like, but I mean,
if they had shot him in the head after they hung him, you know.
Yeah, or if, but any great thing like that, like, you know, pick anything from literature. I know Jane Austen, right? Like, she spends the entire novel saying these two people are falling in love. Now I've got to keep them apart until the last page, right? I mean, it's, you know, like, there are really, it's really hard. You know, if you solve the problem in the first 5 minutes, there is no film. But I don't know. I had no problem. My wife had a bit of a problem with the fact that, like, why do they make such a big deal out of Moriarty when he didn't feature? And I was like, well, sequel.
Yeah.
But she was like, well, I thought he would at least play some role in the story. They weren't just setting this guy up for a sequel.
I'm fine. It's almost like turning it turns it into an origin story without it being an origin story.
And it was a nod to the audience. Hey, you know who this is because you're not stupid, and we don't need to explain it that this guy will become his greatest foe ever.
Yeah. I mean, I knew not about Moriarty, but a friend of mine did all the illustrations for all of Holmes's illustrations and the film, and he had gotten a call from Sony not too long ago that said, "Hey, we're just curious if you're booked for the next couple of years because if this movie does well, we're franchising." So,
And I don't have a problem with that because
I don't either.
Bring it on.
But it's a series of books, right? Like, I mean, point of fact, we know that the premise of the thing is cases, and cases lend themselves well to episodic television or to franchises.
Absolutely.
They thought about that beforehand.
Oh, I think they must have.
No, I'm joking.
I'm sorry, I walked right into that one.
Okay.
Hey, Chaz Jarrett, who was the visual effects supervisor, I thought he did a really good job. He previously did stuff like Speed Racer and Poseidon and Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and stuff, Troy. I think he used to be back at MPC in the day. And the visual effects supervisors from Dean Egg and Framestore were David Vickery and Jonathan Faulkner, respectively, who, again, both have great careers. The thing I was going to flag, though, is for a lot of these people, Harry Potter obviously features very prominently in their CVs. Mm. In fact, in all three cases, I believe all three of those supervisors, be them from Dean Egg and Framestore or independent, worked on various bits of Harry Potter.
And probably still are.
Yes, and still are. Do we feel like that there's any kind of influence happening in England? I mean, there's just such a mixing of talent here between the major houses in London. Because I think one of the big advantages London has is that the houses do work just so well together. They've always, from the earliest days of setting up SohoNet, just been good at doing that sort of stuff. At no point did this feel like there were different sequences to me. Like, if you told me this was all one London house that had done the effect on this, I'd have totally bought it.
Yeah.
It's stylistically, visually, in every other way, just felt completely together.
Yeah, indeed. And obviously, I mean, you've got not just London houses. They all have, you know, there's a lot of stuff. I think it was D-Next, the Reykjavik office did a lot of work. So you don't just have one particular hub. You've got you know, divisions of those houses as well, and still all still then able to create something that's really cohesive. That definitely doesn't feel like, oh well, that entire sequence didn't work. There was only just subtle little elements of a couple of sequences which didn't work, and the rest, as you say, is flawless.
Well, I guess we should do this just to be picky. Was there anything, Jason, that didn't work for you in the film?
The only thing that stood out to me was the, like we were saying, in the boat sequence, the capstans on the chains when they get yanked off. Immediately there was some odd physics to the movement, and I was just like, all right, I just wrote that off. Not that I'm not like disparaging it horribly, but it just stood out amongst the other shots and work as being a little more obvious.
It was less satisfying than you would want the end of a big sequence like that to be.
Yeah.
But I guess, Jace, the question is, if you were directing it, firstly, do you agree? But secondly, do you think there's anything you could have done to make the end of that more vivid and real and less like a big friggin' effect shot?
I didn't have a problem with the sequence or the way it was shot and how it all went together. For me, it was purely just that the look of that capstan. I thought it looked heavy, it looked big. I had no problem with the physics of it. Maybe just had a bit too much motion blur.
Didn't have a bit of Hulk just kind of thrown in there for you?
it just felt a little jerky to me.
Yeah, a little.
It stopped where it shouldn't have stopped. Like, once that thing got moving, there should have been no inertia decrease at all. You know what I mean?
Somebody sitting there right now at Dean Eagle never going,
I told
seen
them.
The freaking,
told
no, no, it's going to be opposite.
You should have seen the five other
we did the simulation on that, and this guy doesn't know what he's talking about because we simulated, and this was exactly what, no, but anyway.
They went with a different version. You should have seen the other one. I think the sequence was, I think if you'd gone too big, then it would have just, you know, pushed it into another realm. I think that it felt, I mean, that's exactly, nothing out of the complete impossible happened there, really. I mean, essentially, you've got, once that ship breaks, you know, breaks free and wants to go, it's going to start to pull a whole bunch of stuff with it. And I think that all felt, there was no sort of leaps of faith required to sort of,
it wasn't a motivation issue. It was just, I'm being hypercritical.
Yeah, I'm same here. It just felt a bit like, hello, digital set. But that's great. I agree. It's a minor point. Hey, the thing for me that was an odd thing that I remember watching it and then since discovered why, there was a scene, it's something to do with visual effects, I guess, but there was a scene where it pauses on the address of the house, and the shot was very, the first Baker Street shot was very kind of odd. It just felt slightly odd in cinematography. And I was thinking to myself, well, this must be just because they're wanting to play up the address and this, blah, blah, blah. Mm. Though, in fact, apparently that was a nod to the Adventures of Sherlock Holmes 1984 series. Apparently the title sequence for that, which I did not know,
right,
tracks down from the street.
Starts on the Baker Street sign.
And it was funny because you've got this problem, haven't you, when you sort of put something in like that, which, of course, an English audience probably would be like, isn't that funny because that's reference to the show from 20 plus years ago, whereas for me, even, you know, and I presume many other people, it was just like slightly odd shot.
I quite liked
it. You liked it?
Yeah, I thought it felt,
it's kind of risk for in jokes, cool. I think, for if you can get too self-referential and too kind of clever.
Yeah
It's a shot I think it's a shot that you can sacrifice that on, you know what I mean, for the people,
because there are quite a lot of nods in this film.
Yeah, if I knew that, I would be excited, like, oh, look at that, you know. But it didn't bother me. I mean, it stuck out. I was like, oh, that's interesting. And then I read that later about the few nods in the film of all the stuff.
Yeah, I guess stylistically, you know, whenever you're dealing with this kind of material, you know, you're caught between a rock and a hard place, because you can get too caught up in making it for the fans and just generally it becomes too bound by the constraints of the previous productions. And by the same token, you don't want to do something that just pays no attention to, you know, previous efforts and denies, because let's face it, I mean, this film has been made before.
No, I'm glad they made it this way, though. It felt incredibly real. I just loved it. The art department was utterly sensational. Art department, wardrobe, the look of it, performances, the casting, every single face has character. There's some brilliant, every little sort of featured extra and, you know, little...
Well, let me ask you this, because you mentioned art department, and one thing I loved, but I would have preferred to see it at the very beginning of the film, and maybe I did and I forgot, is the end title sequence. See, I really liked the end title sequence.
Amazing.
I thought it was very Guy Ritchie-ish, and I would have loved a bit of that at the beginning. There's this kind of trend now to stick as much of the title sequence at the end of the film.
There's a little bit of interesting, you know, all the cobblestone, the village roadshow cobblestones and all that sort of stuff. And then transitioning through the back of the carriage into them in the back of the horse and carriage. That was interesting. That was a little bit of something going from sort of cobblestone pattern to cobblestone pattern. But
did you like the end titles?
I thought they were pretty good. Yeah,
we liked them, didn't we, Jason?
Yeah, I liked them a lot.
Yeah,
that sort of hand-cranked look.
Bloody directors. I keep on dropping, by the way. The thing you're hearing is I'm playing with a component of my Red camera, and I keep dropping it. I'm going to put it down. I apologize. So I'm sure that's very distracting. You've been listening on your iPod.
Is that a top mount?
That was actually the original bracket from, you know, they gave you when you bought the deposit. Yeah. And I've been twisting it on my finger and dropping it. I'm very unprofessional of me.
A sequence that I really like, this is more of just an editing thing, is when Holmes picks up, well, there's two. It's the whole scene, really. When Holmes is waiting for Watson and his fiance, and he's, you know, sort of
at the restaurant?
The din of the restaurant. Yeah, it's coming in and he's like absorbing it all. And then when she sits down and he like tears her apart and tells her her whole life, and they go in on the hand with the tan of the finger with the white ring where the ring used to be, and all those little details. I really, really like that a lot, especially because much like that suggestion later about him being wrong about the fight, he's wrong about the, you know, that her husband didn't leave her, he died. And that, you know, just those little things show, you know, give him a little bit of fallibility.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm sorry, I'm so much of a dork that I really liked the Madam, please remain calm and trust me, I'm a professional. Beneath this pillow lies the key to my release, made screaming sequence. I thought that was good drugging, good resolve of drugging, funny sequence. I mean, I got a laugh out of me. I think the editing on this, which is, I think, the point you're making, Jason, was very good.
I think there's going to be a lot of people doing getting a short walk and a handshake come BAFTA time and Academy Award time. I think there's some utterly award.
Jason, you've just come from it, haven't you, tonight?
I saw it on my Monday night.
No, I'm saying you've just come from an editing session.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You've been in post all day. But I'm just saying, didn't you agree that the editing was just generally really, really strong in this?
Yeah, that totally. No, it was, it was the filmmaking in general is why I was, you know, a little dubious because of the Guy Ritchie thing. I wasn't fully confident on how he's going to handle a period piece, and was he going to make it too, like, you know, was it going to be like Baz Luhrmann making a something, you know, where he overly stylized or what? And he more or less nailed it. I think it's best movie he's made as far as I'm concerned.
Ooh, that's a big call.
Oh, I agree. I think it's his best film. I think it's one of the best English films apart from, you know, the Harry Potters in a long, long time. I think it's going to be a nice,
indeed,
fresh kick up the ass for English film industry. Not that it really needed one, but it's always wonderful to have a really good good film come out of your own home industry.
Well, excellent. Well, that is a high praise and perhaps a good point to finish up because, I'm very glad that you guys liked it so much. I liked it. Perhaps not quite as enjoyable as it could have been had I had a good release print.
Well, the sooner we all move to digital, the better, I think. And
I'm not sure, actually. We weren't looking at a bad digital projection. I'm not even sure that what we're talking about wasn't actually in part a failing of the projection system as opposed to even just the release print, just so you know.
Can I just, going back, just signing off on the whole period piece thing, I thought I guess what let go, obviously there's a lot of the guy, his style coming through, a lot of that fast cutting, a lot of rapid fire, a lot of stylistic stuff that you would say is quite modern. And I think what let him get away with that was the fact that every other department, everybody, there's such love and such such an effort had gone into every other department, the art department, wardrobe, lighting, the propping, the casting. Once you sort of build that framework, I think, and you immerse people and you don't, for the most part, go totally crazy with, spider cam moves from the top of buildings and go nuts with your camera work. It all was fairly grounded. Once you sort of establish this sort of really grounded, all the dialogue, all the script was very, very of the time. Once you sort of build that framework, then it lets you have a bit of freedom with his shooting style and cutting style, editing style, the crazy, you know, the phantom super slow-mo fight sequence, all that sort of stuff, I think is totally allowed to, gives you that freedom to do that kind of stuff, because every other department has totally set the scene and given you, immerse the audience, and you totally buy the era that you're in. And then once you've done that, then I guess it lets you apply another style on top of that.
Yeah, that having sense? A, having that a good foundation.
Is that the mindless ramblings of a,
no, I mean,
of a director with too much cafe?
That is, no, I think that's exactly right. Like, there are many occasions and, I don't know, plot issues and stuff where that, I think, applies. I think you can have a character that is pretty unsympathetic in all respects, but you give them one major redeeming factor and the audience will go with you. And I think you can do that. You've got to have one thing there. And I think if you're going to go that way, yeah, you need to have everything else hitting its mark so that you can take that one thing in a different direction.
Yeah, that's right.
And it was the right decision, clearly, because you guys loved the film. I liked it as well, but you guys liked it, as did the audience, as did the box office. And, it was clearly made to be a commercial success, and it is. So
yeah, I can't wait for the next one.
Yeah, cool.
I wanted to say that I thought the Phantom stuff cut beautifully with the 35. Oh, yeah.
Again,
I mean,
awesome, fantastically filmmaking sequence. The music.
It was really good.
Crafted beyond belief, and it's just sensational. You have to wonder with that punching and stuff, do you, if you go 1,000 frames a second, is any punch going to make someone's face look that distorted, or did they have to then get in there and do some extra stuff? Is that one of the extra 800 or so shots, little things like that, to really distort someone's face, or I don't know. But it was outstanding sequence. Again, his best film. It is his best film.
Well, thank you guys so much for being a host this week. Thank you also for listening. I'm just going to give you something we don't normally do. We're getting our act together in 2010. I'm going to give you a rundown of some of the films coming up, because we now have a schedule. We're going to be coming out every 2 weeks with the VFX show. Not every week, but every 2 weeks, which means our next one will be on around the week of the 25th, and that will be Lord of the Rings. We're going to start looking over time at the various Lord of the Rings films, and our co-topic that week is the birth of massive crowds. And then coming up after that, we'll have True Lies, and then we've got other things coming. New films like Alice in Wonderland, but also more old films that we review and try and find their place in the VFX history. Jason Diamond, thank you so much for being with us.
No problem. Thank you.
Where can people find you, Jason?
The Twitters, which is just Jason Diamond, one word. Also, I just want to say another aside, as I often do in the sign-off. I really appreciated the occult aspect and the way they wrapped up sort of a Masonic OTO / Templar-style organization, which was supposed to be supernatural, which they then sort of debunk and show that it was all done practically, which goes through the whole Holmes thing. But I mean, I have a particular affinity for that esoteric stuff anyway. So I always like to see that, especially in the late 1800s. I mean, that was it. In Victorian England, if you weren't in a secret society, you were a nobody, which kind of seems ironic, but that's how it was. So it was nice to see how they were faithful even to that theme.
A true skeptic like me. Everyone needs to see loves to see those myths being busted.
Yeah. But, yeah, that's me.
Excellent. And Jason Wingrove, where can people find you?
On Twitter, I'm Wingrove, or my website, Real, etc., at jasonwingrove.com.
And
can I plug the other podcast?
Yeah, you certainly can.
Red Center, the podcast that Mike and I do, based on digital cinematography, filmmaking in general. That is fxguide.com/redcenter, or search for Red Center, spelt the correct English way. Search for that in iTunes, I guess.
The Pommy spelling, not the Jason Diamond spelling.
The Queen's English spelling.
Exactly.
Also, you can find us at the VFXshow.com and me personally over at FXguide.com and FXPhD.com. This is a joint production with Pixel Core and FX Guide. I want to thank everybody for listening, and also, as I say, keep an eye out for those new shows coming up as we try and be a bit more regular. And our next one, as I say, Lord of the Rings, coming up in a week or two. Thanks, guys.